Hello and welcome to The Signal. I'm Shazara Khan.
And I'm Sabine Antigua. We're with the audio workshop at the University of King's College School of Journalism.
And this is our last show for the term.
Today on the program, the legend of a campus ghost.
And I turned and looked and there was absolutely nobody there.
And a new technology that might make you uncomfortable.
It puts you in a position where they're going to ask for more of it than you would really like them to have.
Plus, coming soon to Brunswick Street, a Filipino bake shop serving up treats.
Goal is like to share our culture to Canadians and locals.
All that and more on today's show. It's almost time for the holidays, and that means lots of people on campuses around Halifax will be going home for the break. But there's one person at the Dalhousie campus who can't leave. I talked to some people and they all said the same thing, that her name is Penelope, and she haunts Sheriff Hall. It's a chilling tale. In the 1920s, a young woman fell in love with a professor and ended up pregnant. Some say she was a student. Others say a maid. Her lover abandoned her, and she threw herself from the roof of the building. Up a set of steps on South Street is Sheriff Hall. It's managed by Mateo York, who says students have been telling the story for ages. He shared with me some of the creepiest experiences people had.
Penelope was spotted walking down the hallway as an apparition, a young woman in a nightgown or something like that, and she was leaving wet footprints as she walked up the hallway, then turned left and walked through a wall where maybe at one time there was a door, but the footprints led to the wall and then just stopped.
York says he's not a huge believer of the paranormal, but he's open to all possibilities. Especially after his eerie encounter.
I was here by myself one day in the summertime when it was really quiet, and I was in the dining hall, and I heard very clearly a woman's voice say, "Hello," and I turned and looked, and there was absolutely nobody there.
York isn't the only one with a dining hall experience. Some students have noticed there's something wrong with the lights.
They just flicker, and we always joke that Penelope's there.
The fourth floor is part of the older section of Sheriff Hall. That was where Penelope has been spotted walking around. And that's where a lot of students are afraid to go, especially at night.
There's been a lot of negative energy around Sheriff recently, and I've done a few rituals to bring up the positivity around Sheriff. Like, I light incense, I've been like doing some rituals, and like, this girl will not leave us alone. Her spirit is haunting us.
When I'm taking like my late night walks at night, is very creepy and mysterious.
I don't know if it's like because it's designed different, but you can definitely tell like there's something off about the fourth floor. It's scary.
Some of the students even have a message for Penelope.
Penelope, babes, man, I'm sorry. What happened? You gotta like off it. Like leave me alone. Like leave everybody alone.
The story of Penelope has become a campus legend. She was first mentioned in the campus newspaper in the 1990s and has been talked about ever since. York says the story is important to Sheriff Hall's identity.
It gives the students that live here and even the staff that work here a bit of a connection to that 100-year-old history that the building has.
He says there's no documentation and there's been no research into her life. But for students at Sheriff Hall, Penelope lives on as an oral tradition.
I did not know that about Sheriff Hall. I'm kind of glad that I don't live in residence now.
Yeah, I went there and went to the fourth floor and it was
the
really eerie.
The vibe was off.
The vibe was off. It was really eerie and I'm also glad that I don't live there and I never want to go there.
Fair enough.
Thank you. there's a new technology on the horizon that's going to affect everyone. It's called digital ID, and it means your important personal information will be stored in the cloud. But some people are worried. Connor McDowell has been looking into this for us and joins me in the studio. So, Connor, what's digital ID?
At its simplest, digital ID is what it sounds like. Canadians move data about themselves onto the cloud and then access it or give access to it from their phones. So things like your age, health information, certificates for skills and work, your education, you name it. Instead of showing a card, you'll be able to give access to these things through your online database. But the devil is in the details. At least that's what opponents are saying. It's very controversial in Canada. On the one hand, some are saying digital ID is a serious threat to rights and freedoms. And on the other hand, people are saying digital ID is just convenient and it's going to solve problems like fraud.
Okay, we'll get to that. But first, you said this is coming to Canada?
Yeah, it's been in development for 8 years.
Okay, who's developing it?
It's a government-corporate partnership. It's a group called the Digital Identification and Authentication Council of Canada, or DIAC. Just to give you an idea, the board of directors is made up of people from TD Bank, Interact, TELUS, the government of New Brunswick, Ontario, Quebec, BC, among others.
Okay, so what are the concerns about digital IDs?
Digital ID introduces new technology to the world, and the tech makes a lot of new things possible. For example, the vaccine passport, that was digital ID. Critics say this tech opens up a can of worms in society. They're worried businesses and governments will have too much access to too much personal information.
And what about the convenience of digital ID?
Supporters say there are a few major benefits to digital ID, like that it's going to make government services easier to access, and it will save a lot of money by reducing problems like identity fraud.
Right, and you've been speaking with people in the digital ID world, haven't you?
Yeah, I have. Martin Halverson works at the Justice Center for Constitutional Freedoms. He's managing their No Digital ID campaign.
Even in a world where the software is 100% reliable and can't be hacked, can't be broken, in a world where the government doesn't interfere with your personal affairs, you are still holding the keys to all of your personal data. And so every agency that you interact with is going to know that you have the keys to all of your data with you. And it puts you in a position where they're going to ask for more of it than you would really like them to have. And there's going to be some coercion, like say you're trying to get a visa to visit relatives in Europe, for instance. And the host government of whatever country wants information that you're not really comfortable sharing, and you know you're going to be excluded for it.
That's actually really interesting.
Yeah, so I took that point from Halverson about being asked for too much information. I took it to an engineer who works in the digital ID space. Adam Lemon talks about this problem as gating, the idea that you don't get access unless you share some information.
I would struggle to see many organizations that are going to add new forms of gating based on this technology being available all of a sudden. Like, I don't think we're going to see new organizations jumping on this because it ultimately adds a burden to them, and it reduces the size of their markets for the clientele to come in. So I think even with the vaccination records, I think just about every single vendor was highly resistant to implementing it, right? Because it added friction to their revenue. You know, it added a new step to getting customers in the restaurants.
The interesting part here is that during the pandemic, businesses were forced to gate customers. This wasn't really the vendor's decision. So I asked Adam if we could see more of this top-down enforcement through digital ID technology. He said it's possible. So the question is, will governments use digital ID technology to enforce similar things in the future? Say you drive a polluting vehicle and the government decides it's phasing them out. Suddenly you can't access a toll bridge or a highway. Esther Dreiberg leads the Trusted Digital Identity Program at Deloitte, and part of her job is partnering with governments in the digital space. She says she's not worried.
And the reason we trust the government is because we know there are laws in place that protect our privacy, our security, and, you know, our access to services. we're going to have laws that kind of duplicate the same rights and privileges that we have in an analog world.
Right. So it comes down to a question of trust.
That's what Esther said. Essentially, do Canadians trust their government will uphold rights and freedoms as it brings forth this digital ID technology? You can expect to hear more about this over the coming year.
Thank you, Connor.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Downtown Halifax is about to get its first Filipino bakery and cafe. Zena's Bread and Butter is expanding from its humble origins at Alduny Market to a brick-and-mortar outlet on Brunswick Street. I popped by to check it out.
My favorite, so many things in my favorite, I will tell you. Donut.
Omaima El Kamash is a big fan of the little Filipino bakery called Zena's Bread and Butter at the Alduny Farmers Market in Dartmouth. For the last 3 years, Griselda Alvarez and Mary Grace Fermeza have been pleasing their customers with Filipino favorites like encimada.
Mixed with the cream cheese and cheese inside, around, and on the top of it, so it's like a triple delight, something for dessert.
Mary Grace says that what started out as a craving for their favorite desserts from home soon turned into an opportunity to share their culture with Halifax and make some extra money.
We name it after our cat, Zena. We do bake and sell at first online until we got our Filipino community and consistently our clientele. Then we were able to retail our products in different Filipino stores, and as well as we were able to get into the market.
Zena's Bread and Butter specializes in goods inspired by classic Filipino pastries. One of their most popular products? The purple yam donuts.
I like the... these ones here, so the purple yam. These donuts, I guess, you know, the sweet tooth. So this is a real treat for me.
It's really so delicious. Why? Because it's not too much sweet.
Also on offer, savory pork or chicken buns, Spanish cheese bread, and chocolate crinkles. And this is just their side hustle. During the week, the pair work full-time as home care providers. Griselda explains how they make it work.
So from 8 o'clock in the morning, we work as home care. At 8 p.m., we just go home straight, rest a little bit, shower, and then go to the commercial kitchen to bake for the next morning. So that's the routine every Friday night.
All that hard work pays off. With the growing demand for more products and the encouragement of their home care patients, Mary Grace and Griselda set their sights on opening a cafe in downtown Halifax.
The design's going to be like Filipino-Canadian, so our goal is like to share our culture to Canadians and locals.
Still, the duo says there's no intention of giving up their home care profession entirely. They're taking a few weeks off work to get everything running before leaving their cafe in the care of staff. And Mary Grace hopes that customers will appreciate its unique blend of cultures.
Super excited but nervous at the same time because we don't know how people will react to our new space, but hopefully they will like it with all those different concepts that we put in.
Despite some delays last month, Zena's Bread and Butter is now on track for a soft launch just before Christmas. And Shazara, I tried the Spanish bread. It was masarap.
Masarap?
Yeah, that means delicious in Tagalog.
You're listening to The Signal on CKDU 88.1 FM in Halifax and at Signal HFX on Twitter. You can also hear us on SoundCloud. Just search King's Radio Room.
We're making radio in Mi'kma'ki, the unceded land of the Mi'kmaq people.
We're bringing you stories from the audio workshop at the University of King's College School of Journalism. I'm Shazara Khan.
And I'm Sabine Antigua. Still to come on the show, a refugee tells us about their experience.
It's not easy to be here alone, but I will work to make it here. I wish more people knew how difficult it is outside Canada for us.
And we'll find out about a local program trying to sponsor LGBTQ+ refugees.
And Andrew Lamb takes us through the challenges with fighting gender-based violence.
It's protecting perpetrators and organizations and silencing survivors.
We'll hear what advocates are demanding. Many of us look forward to Christmas holidays, a time of the year filled with cheery celebrations and gifts under the tree. The best gift for some, however, a chance for a new life. The Rainbow Refugee Association of Nova Scotia has launched a holiday giving campaign with that goal. Natalia Tola reports.
Air Canada Express Flight 8581 is now ready for boarding.
Halifax is the destination for LGBTQ plus people from countries where they are persecuted for their sexuality, gender orientation, or gender identity. That's why the Rainbow Refugee Association of Nova Scotia, or RANS, is raising money. They're hoping to resettle 8 LGBTQ plus newcomers next year. Rhiannon Makahoniak is the group's executive director. She says it's important to think of this community during Christmas.
This population of people is a more vulnerable population. I don't love using the word vulnerable, but they face additional barriers, oppression, etc., even within the migration system. Maybe the country they're living in now isn't quite better. Around the world, queer and trans people deserve to have free and dignified lives to exist how they want to exist.
Ana Maria can relate to this. She is an LGBTQ plus refugee. Her journey to Canada has truly been a roller coaster.
It's not easy to be here alone, but I will work to make it here. I wish more people knew how difficult it is outside Canada for us. I wish people knew all the effort we put to be here.
In order to help refugees start a new life, RANS needs about $15,000 for each newcomer.
So that money goes directly to the people that we work with to pay for things like housing, cell phone, groceries, medical and personal needs, and, you know, any type of joy that they want, going to the movies, getting a coffee, etc.
Makahoniak explains that housing and community building are key needs for LGBTQ plus refugees.
It's very hard to find housing, and oftentimes when folks arrive in Halifax due to, you know, their budget and income, they're not able to get, you know, single rooms or apartments, one bedrooms, bachelors, etc., and need to share space with other people. So a really critical thing is finding queer and trans-friendly spaces for these people to live and exist. Because, you know, if we're not safe at home, that just throws a wrench into, like, every other aspect of our lives.
She says RANS is also focused on building connections amongst the refugees. They host pottery nights, painting nights, and they're going to go bowling tomorrow. Ana Maria believes that in Canada, her dream to finally express herself will come true.
Coming to Canada is exciting but scary. I get the opportunity to feel free and feel like myself finally. I love the feeling of freedom.
And for RANS, that's the ultimate goal, providing newcomers the opportunity to find happiness. For The Signal, I'm Natalia Tola.
For our next segment, we'll be discussing gender-based violence. Please take care when listening. People who work with survivors of gender-based violence say the Nova Scotia government needs to do more to combat the problem. The Signal's Andrew Lam was at a vigil Tuesday night in Halifax, commemorating the National Day of Remembrance and Action to End Gender-Based Violence. It marks the 33rd anniversary of the École Polytechnique massacre, in which a man gunned down 14 women. Andrew, thanks for being here. Could you tell us what this year's vigil was like?
As you can hear, Sabine, about 100 people gathered to mark the day and learn from feminist speakers. At times, there was a sense of community as people gathered with friends and loved ones, and some even brought their dogs. But other parts were more somber. One of the main things I took away was that gender-based violence continues to be a systemic problem which touches every part of our communities. The speakers at the vigil say it has to be looked at from multiple perspectives. So education, housing, food security, these all impact someone's risk. I spoke with Christina Fifield, who works at the Avalon Sexual Assault Center and is a trauma therapist with 13 years experience. She says, for example, the lack of public transportation in rural communities or the housing crisis make it harder for somebody to get support when experiencing gender-based violence. You know, if you can't easily find affordable housing, how are you going to leave a partner who's abusive?
Yeah, that makes sense. And are there any signs this problem is getting better?
Well, researchers and advocates both say that gender-based violence is actually getting worse. According to the Nova Scotia Advisory Council on the Status of Women, 2021 and 2020 were the two worst years out of the last eight. They identified 1,500 domestic violence cases in which women were at high risk to die. Meanwhile, I think we've all heard now about the Winnipeg Police Service's recent announcement that an alleged serial killer may have killed four Indigenous women. And this comes more than 3 years after the national inquiry into missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. Clearly, it's still a big problem. I also spoke with Elle Jones. She works with imprisoned women, and she told me about her experience just in this past week.
I mean, like, I've literally spent all week running around with Black women who are being multiply criminalized. So, you know, like, they have a history of domestic violence where a man has choked them. Then they're getting violently arrested by the police and responding out of trauma and then being charged with resisting.
That certainly sounds like a very nuanced and hard situation. So what do advocates want to see happen to help end gender-based violence?
So Fifield and Avalon want the province to pass Bill 144, which is currently before the legislature. The bill would stop the misuse of non-disclosure agreements, or NDAs, to hide details of sexualized violence and discrimination cases. NDAs are legal agreements which can stop women from talking about their experience. Fifield talked about why this is important.
Many powerful institutions, organizations, and workplaces are using these tools, and the way that they're being used, it was never intended to be used in this way. They were supposed to be non-disclosure agreements were to protect trade secrets. And many employers now are using them in a way to cover up and to hide workplace sexualized violence that is happening. And it's protecting perpetrators and organizations and silencing survivors.
So I asked the province about their perspective on the bill, but didn't receive a response in time for broadcast. Elle Jones also says we need to create policies which address the challenges racialized and marginalized communities face.
So there's not dedicated provincial funding for, like, Black women who experience criminalization in multiple ways, right? Like, these services don't exist, so Black women end up trapped between systems.
Jones was also a lead author on January's Defunding the Police report for Halifax. She says we need to reimagine safety outside of policing.
The most vulnerable people are those who are least likely to reach out to the system, to report their rape, to call the police. So I do think it's obviously important that whether that's through transformative justice or envisioning different ways of community or how we educate, that we're looking at how do we really address this violence at its roots in our communities.
And what's the province actually doing about all of this?
Well, last month, the province, alongside the federal and other provincial governments, signed on to the National Action Plan to End Gender-Based Violence. This means that those governments will have common priorities to work towards. Fifield says it's a good first step, but she's waiting to see how that translates into actual action from the government. In a statement obtained by The Signal, the province didn't provide further details about the action plan, but one of the actions the government says it has taken is redeveloping the domestic violence training given to police and service providers. They didn't provide any additional details about that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Andrew, thanks for telling us all about this.
You're welcome. And I should mention, if anyone listening is experiencing gender-based violence or needs support, you can call or text the Bryony House Distress Line at 902-422-7650. That's 902-422-7650. Or for emergencies, dial 911 or the Mental Health Mobile Crisis Unit.
It's that time of year again when NASCAD students prepare for one of their largest events of the Christmas season, the Winter Art and Craft Market, where students from all across programs get the chance to present and sell their works to the public. Alec Gallant has more.
This week, the Christmas spirit is in the air around NASCAD as students prepare for the annual Winter Art and Craft Market. Bea Learn is with the NASCAD Student Union. This is her first year organizing the event.
We're really excited to be able to give the public, like, everything that NASCAD makes. You've got some ceramic sculptures and dishes, utility ware that'll be sold at the Clay Club table and just by different vendors.
And Learn says the market will have much more.
We've got patches and stickers, which are always super popular. We'll have handmade stickers and hand-sewn patches from different fashion students or stickers from illustration majors, which are really exciting for the more convenient gift shopping. But there'll be photos and clothes.
Lucia Mills is a ceramic student at NASCAD and will be one of the vendors at the event.
I created a new line of jewelry that was in ceramics, which is something I've never done before. And I was like, this is a great chance, like through the school, to see if there's interest in that kind of product. And to make a name for myself, or at least start to make a name for myself in the craft and selling world.
This is Mills' first time selling her jewelry line and ceramics at a market. She hopes the money made during the event will help pay for supplies she needs to continue doing what she loves.
Jewelry making is not cheap. Everything I make uses silver or gold as accents, and therefore those kind of things have to be bought out of pocket. In order to make more, I need to sell to make enough money to make more, so keep experimenting.
Mills hopes people will remember the smaller local artists this holiday season, especially students.
Remember that when you're buying gifts for the holidays, local makers need your support, and that a gift means more when it comes from someone local, I feel, instead of from a big commercial consumer.
You can catch Learn and Mills at the market this evening from 5 p.m. to 9 p.m. and tomorrow from 1 p.m. to 4 p.m. at the Granville Mall in downtown Halifax. For The Signal, I'm Alec Gallant.
That's our show for today.
If there's anything you want to hear again, we post links to our stories on Twitter. Our handle is SignalHFX.
Thanks to our producer, Natalia Tola, and our social media editor, Alec Gallant.
A shout out to our technician, Mark Pinio, in the control room.
Our audio professor is Pauline Dakin. I'm Sabine Antigua.
And I'm Shazara Khan. Thanks for listening, and happy holidays!